The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This summer, enjoy boating, biking, and hiking in Ottawa's fresh outdoor spaces. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's July 17th, 2024 at 2:34 in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams. We're back, the Mincing Rascals podcast, which you can hear Saturday nights on WGN Radio at 8. You can catch my show weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Marge Halperin, a former journalist, current commentator on CTV in Canada, here on the Mincing Rascals, communications professional, drawing on government reform experience, about a decade of that, whatever I can do to challenge authority.
I'm Austin Burt from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago and WCIU, a contributor to many other outlets.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, now doing the Chicago History Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the former Tribune columnist and current publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, one of America's finest Substacks, in my opinion.
Our man Brandon Pope, wearing sunglasses and a gray suit, is in Milwaukee at the RNC. We're going to chat with him for just a short while and then let him get back to his discovery of things north of the Cheddar Curtain. By the way, a post of Brandon's has gone viral. Having said that, the food scene in Milwaukee is seriously underrated. He then posted a picture of a pasta board, think a long charcuterie, but instead of cheeses and meats, you got three different scoops of spaghetti. And the world went mad, said one, "I'm not eating spaghetti off a 2x4. About that, on a shared Google Doc this afternoon, our Eric Zorn said, "History will speak of the pre-pasta pope and the post-pasta Pope." John Hansen, your friend and colleague, Brandon, said, "I am super proud to have been the first comment on the monstrosity that was the pasta plank," and really got the meatball rolling on that one. And then pesto, he wrote, "Everyone piled on." Also, serving pasta in Milwaukee, he said during the RNC, "I'm surprised that they don't have a dish called 'The 2020 Election Was Rigatonied.'" Marge then said, "Ha, can't cavatappi that one." Zorn then said, "Penny for your thoughts, Brandon." Marge countered with, "Anyone else want to elbow in?" Brandon said, "Y'all had to really use your noodle for these." And finally, Eric Zorn said, "Far full it be from me to top Marge." Oh, you guys.
And I did not participate.
I just feel awful that I was too busy to be punning this morning.
Brandon, you went to a restaurant and got this pasta board.
I'm surprised, man. I didn't think it was that controversial. I was just hungry. And it was great pasta. It's homemade. It's owned by a real Italian man. It took on a life of its own. I thought it was going to be a fine little cute little food scene post. And now I got people viscerally just like, "Oh, this is awful. This is an insult to food. This really showcases how bad Milwaukee's got to be." And it's not fair. I think it was a delicious dish. I would do it again. I may do it before I leave.
Where would you go? Where was that, Brandon?
It was called Dorsha on Brady Street, which Brady Street here in Milwaukee, very popping area, lots of great food and bars around here. And yeah, it's a big highlight. I thought it was really good food, really. I had a duck carbonara, a lobster mac with gorgonzola. It was like a picante pasta with chicken on there. Like a lot of great variety and great flavors. And it was homemade, once again. Homemade pasta, way different than the stuff you get at Target.
I don't understand. How could anyone object to this? I think it's genius.
I think it looked delicious.
Right?
I thought it looked good. Okay, and I want to talk about food anymore. I want to talk about this. So, Brandon, we talked to Congressman Darren LaHood, the Republican from Peoria, who represents the North Central Corridor in Illinois. And he said that there is a spring in the Republican step and that they are unifying in Milwaukee. What are you seeing, hearing, and feeling up there?
Yeah, I think a lot of people had questions coming in about what the mood was going to be after the assassination attempt of former President Donald Trump. And really, it's been electric and, yeah, unifying. And I'd also say a feeling of confidence. Everyone I talked to, across the spectrum here is very confident that Donald Trump is going to win in 2024. It's almost like they feel like they've won already. they really have that kind of pep in their step. And when you press them on issues that have come up in the campaign, like Project 2025, they see them as non-issues. They think that at this point, this election is about Joe Biden's age, and that is that's an election win for them, they think. So it's a celebratory move. It's almost like they feel like they've already won the election. And at the same time, as you would expect, very antagonistic media views, right? Like, I don't know if you saw the Carrie Lake speech, where she literally went on stage and said, you know, worn out your welcome here. Like, that being said, I've had a great time. No one's been mean to me. they're only mean when they're on stage or in front of the
So
camera.
Rome is falling, but the spaghetti is good. Okay, fair enough.
Absolutely, man. But it's fascinating, though. I've been here really doing a long-form piece on Black voters and Black voting trends and talking with a lot of Black GOP and Black conservatives and getting their perspective overall, because there has been a bit of a bump with Donald Trump in particular for Black support for his candidacy. He got more Black votes in 2020 than any Republican candidate in 25 years. And then 2024, a lot of polling showing Joe Biden losing Black support and Donald Trump potentially gaining some of that. So it's been interesting hearing from, you know, Tim Scott of the world and the Representative Byron Donald and other. I talked to Richard Irvin, the Aurora mayor, about all these things, why they think that the Black community might be leaning toward Republican candidates, why they believe that the Democratic Party may be losing some Black people, specifically Black men. Really fascinating conversations here. Mm-hmm. As you can tell, the mood here, they really feel like they've got this thing in the bag.
Yeah, I get
not
that.
Just at the presidential level, but down ballot.
What is the answer you're getting, Brandon, from these Black elected officials as to why Black voters, some of them, are migrating over to Trump?
It's varied answers. One that I hear the most is Black men in particular do not feel like they have a home within the Democratic Party. They feel like the party itself caters more toward Black women, and that the issues that Black men tend to deal with are things that appeal more to Black men. You can debate whether that's true or not. Me personally, I disagree, but hey, there are plenty of Black men here that would say the opposite, right? You also have a thought process out there that it's been years and years and decades of Democrats running things in majorly Black cities and, you know, Chicago and other cities like that, with disinvestment still, bad results for Black communities.
Okay, I see that.
And so their thought process is, okay, Republican policies, conservative policies may be better for Black Americans. I tried to press Tim Scott on what exactly he means by that. He kept using the word opportunity zones. He loves that word, opportunity zones, and flooding opportunity zones with investment. However, he hasn't specified what that means exactly. It's like a new buzzword. It's just been interesting. I think there is some merit to that for sure, that the Democratic Party may be missing the mark, especially with a generation of Black Americans. I'd say my generation, millennials and younger. So the Republicans, they have an opportunity, if they message right, to take advantage of that.
I sat in on a webinar a couple days ago with the woman who runs the New Georgia Project, targeting voters of color, but particularly Black voters. And they did extensive research with policy issues. You know, we talk about low information voters, and I think there's a lot of crossover with some of the groups that you mentioned. And what they did is they were focus groups, so it's a qualitative, not quantitative research, but they shared with them some key messages about policies that Biden has put into effect in the last 3 years and asked, do these policies impact your lives? 70%. It was like a crazy number. Oh, yes, these will impact my life. These will make my life better. And then they said, these are things that Biden has been able to do so far in his term. Are you inclined to vote for Biden-Harris? And a minimum of 35% up to 45% said, yes, this was true with women, with men, with people over 50, people under 50, although they didn't go like under 30. I mean, it didn't hit quite the lower target. But the implication for those of us who organize is that the issues are what matter. That's what Biden keeps saying. Whether it matters more than his age is another question. But when informed about the things that change their lives, people respond positively, and that seems to be our path. Does that resonate with the research that you're doing or the conversations you're having?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of it is about the policies put forward. And I'm actually curious what these next couple of weeks are going to look like for the Trump campaign, the Biden campaign. We're just seeing some news come out that Joe Biden is wanting to introduce a measure to potentially alleviate medical debt for Americans. That is a policy that I think would benefit a lot of Black Americans who there's a hidden secret in the Black community. Black people don't like going to the doctor. Why? Because they can't afford to go to the doctor. And so because of that, they kick the can forward. That's why diabetes is high, high blood pressure. If you can wipe out medical debt and alleviate that for so many people and alleviate that stress and that anxiety of just getting a checkup, that helps out so many people, not just Black Americans, Americans writ large. So if the Biden-Harris ticket puts out more substantive policy that people can see a real impact, the credit score stuff they were talking about as well with medical debt not impacting your credit score, like these are things people can actually see and apply instead of talking about a CHIPS Act or the stock market, you know?
I like the medical debt issue a lot, and I think it will sell better with voters than the relieving student debt. On the other hand, I think voters are going to say, what took you so long? Dude, you've been in office for almost 4 years, and now suddenly when your back's against the wall, you come up with this. And also he came up with some Supreme Court reforms that he wants now suddenly.
It's like that
he'd been and rent control. Things that he had blocked or fought in previous years, suddenly he's seeing the light on these things. And I think there's voters can be very cynical. I'm pretty cynical about stuff like that. Like, you know, if you were running for president and saying these things, that's one thing. But he's asking to be reelected as president, and he's had 3.5 years, and he hasn't said any of these things. So I don't know how well that's going to work.
The new slogan is when they go right, we go left.
But what fascinates me here is that Joe Biden fighting for his political life, the people who have been defending him hardest have been the left flank of the party, the Bernie Sanders, the AOCs. And so I think what's happening is some gamesmanship. You're seeing Bernie Sanders and AOC say, all right, we're going to stick our neck out for you. We're going to keep you on the ticket, but you're going to have to
appeal to what
we want. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think that's what's happening.
I think rent control was a great example of just like throwing Hail Marys, any buzzwords that would stick. The problem with that was, I mean, he had a speech to the NAACP and misstated what his actual policy was. It was supposed to be a cap of 5% increases. He's reading off a teleprompter and said something like capped at $55, which doesn't make sense. And I this is not related to Biden, but I think rent control in particular is, if we say follow the science, is one of the most universally derided policies by economists, because it's a price control and it results in lower quality housing. It reduces, it increases the shortage of housing, decreases mobility. There's so much evidence on this, but I think Brandon's right. It's like he's throwing out just like, you know, these policy solutions, seeing what will stick.
Oh, there you go again with your facts and science and stuff.
I also hate to be as cynical as Eric is, but it doesn't just seem like it. He is throwing out a lot of progressive things that he sort of backed but hadn't really done anything about. And he is doing that pretty explicitly for their support so that they're not among the people calling for him to step down. I heard a pretty long interview with Bernie Sanders a couple days ago where he was like, yeah, is that what I'm doing? Yeah, that's what I'm doing. So what? I'm supporting him because he wants to press all these progressive things that I care about.
Well, is that just to court the Black vote?
Progressives in general.
But every demographic will matter, I guess, in an election that maybe will be close, maybe won't. But it would seem to me like catering to just the most progressive possible voters might not be the surest path. You've got to get people from the suburbs and so on and so forth, too, right?
But his first thing is to not be forced to step down. So right now, he's really looking to shore up support with specific members of Congress.
I think the idea overall, too, is that, and this is what Bernie Sanders and his kind of wing of that left party tries to push, is that they believe some of these progressive policies are applicable to working class people. And writ large, you don't have to be a far left person to want to have these policies that impact your pocketbook and things like that. There's a synergy there. I think you can weave with Joe Biden, working class Joe, and some of these things that Bernie Sanders wants to push, while activating the very bases that Joe Biden right now, all polling shows, has not activated. Mm-hmm. That is, if he's going to have any chance in this election, you got to get these folks to wake up. And right now, they just think the couch is the better option right now than going to the polls. You got to excite people. And let's be honest, Joe Biden is not exciting.
The topic about him is tantalizing or fascinating or interesting or important. By the way, we're going to let you go now, Brandon, but what's your next now event? What's your afternoon or evening like?
Yeah, I'm about to hop on WVON 1690, talk a little bit about some more of this topic with black voters. I've got an interview with Trump's director of black outreach at 4 o'clock to kind of talk about their specific strategy or lack thereof in black voters and where they see black voters factoring into their campaign.
You look good, buddy. Have a good time up there.
Hey, thanks, y'all. Have a good one.
Our man Pope, Pasta Pope, pre and post Pasta Pope. By the way, you guys, what do we make of the fact that Nate Silver's 538 forecast, which goes beyond just the raw polling. I mean, all the polling on 538 says that Donald Trump is right now going to win if the election were today. But when he takes into account other factors and then runs 1,000 permutations of what could happen in the next election, he has Joe Biden winning in 54% of the runs to Donald Trump's 46% chance of winning. I'm not exactly sure what I just said, but I think the point is that the election isn't determined yet. However confident the Republicans should rightly be today, it ain't over. In fact, it's still more than close.
They do put a healthy amount of weight on non-polling factors. So they take in things like into account stuff like economic growth or like other raw political indicators that aren't polls. So it might take time for that model to kind of come around to what the polls are showing. And the polls are showing in almost every swing state, Trump is now up. And that was not the case a month ago. So polling indicators just show, however, a snapshot of today. They don't show what the future will hold in 100 days. And as we've seen, that can change really rapidly. Many of those factors can change really rapidly and change poll numbers. So I think it's very premature for people to be saying, you know, Biden's out, race is over. However, Democrats are rightly panicking about the current numbers because it's hard to envision a scenario where the key drivers of Biden's drop in the polls, which seems to be is an increased realization of the realities of his age and capacity affecting his ability to communicate. It's hard to see how something like that changes between now and election
day. Yeah, that's not going to get better.
It won't get better. So the fundamental issue there, I think, is what has people panicking, even though there is lots of time left. In fact, the fact that there's lots of time left could suggest that it's only going to get much worse. That's more time for more gaps.
But it could also get better too. I still imagine a scenario where there's almost a sympathy vote, or when people take into account all of the leverage and momentum that the Republicans have, and that it almost scares them, you know, between the Supreme Court and Project 2025 and Donald Trump maybe actually having both houses in the Congress, people might say, okay, we got to vote for Biden. In fact, the markets are great and crime isn't so bad right now. And if immigration is an issue, it doesn't seem to be affecting my life personally. I just wonder if people will take stock of some of that stuff. I know I asked about this last week and then go, you know what? Joe Biden can't talk well, but let's not give the reins to Donald Trump. I wonder if there's enough time for the pendulum to go that way. Marge, you think there's something to that?
Well, there's room to do the work, you know, and there's a lot of good work that's happening to get those messages out. As I mentioned, the Georgia research earlier, there's the Wisconsin Democrats, who my Indivisible Chicago group works very closely with them. They've identified 11,000 voters in the Southwest quadrant where we can go and canvass and make phone calls and do the work easily. 11,000 voters who have shown progressive proclivity or Democratic support in the past, but disinclined to vote or maybe aren't re-registered. And we're tackling that list. We knocked on 1,000 doors in one Sunday afternoon. Like, you could reach those 11,000 people, talk to them about the issues, and use the rationale you just described, John, and reach them. There's another group that has done a cross-check, a database check, of voters in the six key swing states who have changed their address, who are not currently registered at the address where they live, sent them filled out registration forms, and now we're chasing those with phone banks, calling people and saying, we sent you the new application. You haven't submitted it yet. You need help. So we're tracking these extra votes, and the Republican Party has been shrinking.
You're talking about that database was in the southwest part of Chicago or in the Chicago area. Is that what you're talking about?
It's southwest Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Oh, that was actually
Wisconsin
for Wisconsin.
Democrat.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You're working on the swing states, so that was a Wisconsin
yes.
effort. Yeah.
Can I pour a bunch of cold water on everything?
Bring it on, Kate.
Sorry. I'm not quite sure where the numbers are that you read off, but like 538 in the polls is showing Trump at 42.4% versus Biden at 40.3%.
Yeah, I see that too.
Okay.
But again, this is not just an analysis of the polls. It's not an aggregate of the polls. It's some of those other factors.
But if you go by the Electoral College, for instance, the trajectory has been consistent for over a year. Trump always being ahead of Biden, and that means something. And if you look at the swing states, Biden was down in six of the seven swing states.
I can't help you with that. All I'm saying is that if you factored in some of these other issues, I think the more you factor in,
the worse it looks.
Yeah. You know, did you guys have this sort of reaction as soon as Trump held up his fist with his face bloodied? You thought, oh, my God, he's going to win. That's the moment. That's the man. That's the defiance. That's the strength. I mean, isn't that a weird thing to think that it would have a positive outcome? But in that instant, I thought, wow, what a powerful moment. Sympathy, strength, the election is sealed. Was I the only one thinking that way?
You clearly were not. Lots of people were thinking that. And I don't think that when you think it through, you think, well, okay, he got nicked on the ear. He's bleeding at the ear. And it's clearly not a very serious wound. And he's going to be fine. And I'm glad about that. But it plays into this broader narrative that Trump is strong and Biden is weak. And then you'll see Biden's interview with Lester Holt the other night where he just he trails off in his thoughts. He just is not in – doesn't strike someone in command, and he keeps looking back. He doesn't look forward. To touch back on these polls, I looked at the Real Clear Politics average of polls. They have Trump winning in every single swing state. His average lead of 4.3 percentage points in those things. And 4 years ago, Biden was up in a similar collection of battleground states by 5.3 percentage points. And Biden barely won because of the way the Electoral College map is.
Yeah,
I think they're in real trouble. And I think that the selection of J.D. Vance as the vice president was an extremely confident pick by the Republicans. It was not an outreach to any other constituency. It wasn't like, well, we better have a woman on the ticket or we better have a minority on the ticket. These are two hard conservative white guys, one old, one young, and they are doubling down, tripling down on their MAGA message. They feel like they don't have to do anything else. They have this in the bag. I have heard the same thing that Brandon said earlier, that there's an air of extreme confidence in the Republican convention. And if I were a Republican at that convention, I'd probably be feeling the same way at this point. The Democrats are in disarray. Parties split between people who think that they can, we can just keep telling the public that, oh, he's fine. He's going to be fine for 4.5 years, really. I know he sounds like an old man babbling on the couch, but he's fine. And people like me who say, like, he's not fine. This is not going to sell. We have to bring in a relief pitcher here. And so the Democratic Party, and I can't imagine there's going to be like the kind of enthusiasm in Chicago a month from now as there is in Milwaukee right now.
It would be very weird to see how people would be rallying around Biden or the much anticipated Biden speech. It won't pop. I absolutely understand that, Eric. I do wonder, though, if people, the measure of people's fear about Donald Trump can be gauged in the number of people that will yet vote for Joe Biden. And maybe he doesn't finish the term. Maybe he hands the baton off to Kamala Harris at some point during the 4 years. What we are not measuring here is the anxiety, fear, and distrust people have of Donald Trump, so that it almost doesn't matter, even a Joe Biden, even a Kamala Harris or a Gavin or a Gretchen.
I think you see that in the way, there's many factors influencing this, but I think this is part and parcel with how Trump reacted post-assassination attempt, right? It was about unity, bringing together. That was the message. It's that you don't have anything to fear here. We're going to moderate the RNC platform on issues like abortion and gay marriage, reducing that fear factor that you talked about, which I think is very real. One thing Eric said, I agree with this in the electoral sense, that the J.D. Vance pick is not additive in terms of the constituency that's going to vote for Trump. I do think was an important outreach, perhaps decisive outreach, specifically on the funding side and specifically to Silicon Valley. J.D. Vance is a Peter Thiel pick. Peter Thiel is the co-founder of PayPal. He was the first outside investor in Facebook. He was has been a longtime supporter of J.D. Vance. And you saw once that pick was made, which after that pick was made, you had Elon Musk committing $45 million a month from now until Election Day into backing the Trump campaign. You saw folks in Silicon Valley like David Sachs and Chamath Palihapitiya. These are big people in the Silicon Valley investor world that are now backing a Trump ticket. And you're seeing the vice president as someone from that world. He spent some time in Silicon Valley. That's where he met Peter Thiel, who is now a young leader in the party and is the presumptive nominee for perhaps 8 years from now. So that bit of outreach, I think, actually was very important with the Vance pick.
Yeah, yeah. Just one last thing, because I've talked about 538 too much, but I'll just read, because you all have questions sort of what the hell is Silver talking about when he said if you run 1,000 permutations of this, 539 come out with a Joe Biden victory. They wrote, 538's focus on uncertainty partially explains why our election forecast has not moved much. In effect, we are hedging our bets, putting more weight on the so-called fundamentals, because we believe the campaign could be volatile or polls could be biased. The other big factors explaining our model's relative stability is the flurry of swing state polls that were published over the weekend, most good for Biden. The average swing state poll published since July 6th has Trump leading Biden by 1 point compared to his 2.2 lead in national polls today. 538's forecast is based on a combination of polls and campaign fundamentals such as economic conditions, state partisanship, and incumbency. And then they wrote, it's not meant to call a winner, but rather to give you a sense of how likely each candidate is to win. I'm not sure what the difference between those two things are, but that's just a little more context to why they said 46 for Trump and 54 for Joe Biden.
What were they saying 8 years ago? That's what I want to know. I mean, I remember 8 years ago on election night, the needle at the New York Times was like at 95% for Hillary Clinton early in the evening.
That was based on poll. Look, ask me who do I think is going to win today or tomorrow or the next day, Donald Trump. I was asked that in early June, and I said Donald Trump to a crowd of people that all groaned. I said, well, that's, you asked me who I think is going to win. I don't suppose anybody here thinks Joe Biden's going to win right now. Marge, do you think Biden's going to win?
I see a path, and I think it's a large part of what you said, that the difference is so stark. We have a weak messenger, but our message is strong. Look at the drumbeat around Project 2025. 2 weeks or so ago, there was a survey that 70% of the country didn't know what Project 2025 was.
Sure.
Trump said, I don't know what it is. I don't know who those people are. And then it turns out, you know, 90% of the people who wrote it used to work for him and on and on. And of course, he knows what it is, and it's all the things he wants to do. And we've been talking a lot about it. There's billboards and swing states and a lot of communication about it. I don't know what the current poll is, but people are panicking about it, so much so that Trump is further distancing himself. I'm not going to do that. And then they pretended to change the GOP platform, as Austin said, to moderate their position on abortion. But you know they didn't do that, right? They pulled a specific language about abortion, but then they kept the language about personhood. So if a fetus has or embryo has personhood, there's no abortion, there's no IVF. Their position is as strong as it ever was, and it's still right out of the Project 2025. I got a kind of funny email this afternoon from Billy Wamsett, who runs the Movement Voter Project. They're a national fundraising arm for grassroots groups in the swing states. He says, it's sort of like grandpa had a crisis. It doesn't matter if you like grandpa before or not, but people are rallying around him like he's their favorite grandpa ever. If there's going to be an up note at the DNC, if the next week does not resolve this question in favor of Biden stepping down, and I think there's only a week left in that conversation, and if it doesn't happen next week, I think we will rally and have a positive convention, because this is the direction that we have to go in if it's determined that that's the decision that's made.
That's a hell of a campaign slogan, isn't it? Biden 2024, grandpa had a crisis.
Well, it's more honest than grandpa had a bad night.
Grandpa's in decline, but he's still better than the alternative.
The discussion's not over, Eric, right?
Adam Schiff on Wednesday afternoon came out and said Biden should step aside. Adam Schiff is a pretty big deal. I keep hearing reports that Nancy Pelosi behind the scenes is working really hard to figure out a way to give Biden an off ramp that he clearly needs here. He has dug in. I understand why you would dig in. It makes sense politically to dig in before you're going to climb out. I would think that between Pelosi and Hakeem Jeffries and maybe the Obamas, they could talk.
It would be an interesting strategy, wouldn't it, Eric?
Be in the room.
What about if at the end of the RNC, Monday, you come out and say all that time and money and energy you wasted on Joe Biden, guess what? He's not going to be the candidate. He's going to free up his delegates and it's going to be somebody else. That would own the week, wouldn't it?
It would level the playing field. It'll kill their DNC bounce. It'll probably end whatever bounce he got from the assassination attempt and his attempt to market the heck out of it.
The RNC bounce, you mean? Yeah.
RNC bounce.
It would be
yes.
great. But in response to Adam Schiff asking for him to step down, the campaign merely reiterated that Biden is not going anywhere.
Yeah.
But as Eric pointed out, the Democrats really are in complete disarray. Most of them probably want Biden to step down. We've got at least 20 representatives who have said so on the record, many, many more saying it privately. We've got only one senator who said it publicly, but a couple of more who have expressed their concern, and we know what that means.
Somebody should call Jill. Somebody should call Dr. Biden and say, Jill, can you help us out here? I suggested Barack Obama would be the guy that behind closed doors would do that, and you all reminded me that there's too much ill will there, so okay.
This afternoon, there was a report that Biden is saying that if there was a doctor, if my doctors came to me and told me I need to get out, I would get out. And I wondered if that was just opening the door.
Okay, let's move on to some Chicago stories. Here in Chicago, Mayor Brandon Johnson has backed away from a proposal to fine teenagers who organize street meetups that end in violence. This has been a trend, groups of youth gathering at a set location and then roaming, sometimes wilding through popular spots in town. The ordinance, the Tribune noted, would target unpermitted, publicly advertised gatherings that occur between 10 and 4. Under the legislation, the sponsor of any such event would be fined no less than $10,000. Eric, do you like this idea? Has this got a chance? Is this even constitutional?
I would say no, no, no to your questions.
To all of them.
These trends, as they're called, these parties are out of hand. I don't know that you can say someone you can't organize a gathering, you can't have a party, you can't. I mean, that seems like it goes too far. But I would certainly entertain other ideas as to how to get these events under control. But that just, it doesn't seem like it would, it doesn't seem like it's popular on the council, and it doesn't seem like it's constitutional.
There's so many ways where it sounds like it would just backfire, or just simply not work, because a lot of times the person who starts it might just be a teenager. Are you really going to get $10,000 out of some teenager?
Yeah, do they care?
Or is a teenager possibly going to think about that in advance of asking their friends to get together?
Yeah,
it just seems very unlikely. It's interesting that instead of just coming out with it, that they did at least, I mean, the Brandon Johnson administration, they did run it past all the aldermen last week, who brought up all these possible bad ramifications, so that they backed off of it, even though they had hoped to introduce it and pass it within a week.
Austin, do you have any strong thoughts about the zoning chair and the city council?
Certainly. So you may all recall that the former chair of the zoning committee was Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, Democratic Socialist alderman, top ally of the Chicago Teachers Union and Brandon Johnson. And he physically blocked Alderman Emma Mitz from attending a vote to try to prevent quorum on a vote that would put a non-binding referendum on the ballot regarding whether Chicago should be a sanctuary city. There was also several allegations from Alderman that Ramirez Rosa was threatening that he would hold up key development and zoning changes in their ward if they did not do what he said on that vote, which was to not show up. So there was a censure vote. He was stripped from his leadership role as chair of the zoning committee. And that that committee has been vacant. The chairman of that committee, which is very important for the functioning of city government, has been vacant for several months. So today it was thought that Brandon Johnson had been, he wasn't thought, Brandon Johnson had been working for the past several days on a plan to install Byron Sigcho Lopez as zoning chair. Byron Sigcho Lopez is also a Democratic Socialist. The Chicago Teachers Union and their allies are his number one donor, key ally of Brandon Johnson. And today that was expected to go through, critically, because Brandon Johnson, in a parallel move, was going to install Alderman Burnett, longtime alderman, to the head of Housing Committee, which Sigcho Lopez is currently chair of. That was a smart political move on Johnson's part, because by giving that chairmanship to a member of the Black Caucus, he would be able to shore up Black Caucus support for his ally, Byron Sigcho Lopez. Personally, I think setting aside things like his Sigcho Lopez's support for very misguided, harmful policies, like what was mentioned before, for instance, rent control, it's a bad idea for him to be zoning chair. But more importantly, it's a bad idea for him to be zoning chair because of the exact same dynamics that we saw with Carlos Ramirez Rosa. You have an extremist ideological alderman who is carrying out the bidding of the mayor and holding up key elements of development zoning in exchange for votes on other priorities. So I think it was today that vote was delayed. And in fact, an ally of the mayor delayed that vote on purpose. So we may see it next month. I will only add again on Sigcho Lopez, the last time he was in the news was for speaking in front of the charred remains of an American flag. And I think many people commenting on that commented on simply the fact that he was speaking in front of charred remains. I think that was the least controversial thing about the group that he was partnering with to do that speech. The group is called Behind Enemy Lines. They have partnered with folks who celebrated the massacres of October 7th. They partnered with a group called Samadun, which was banned in Germany for anti-Semitism, and has been working with them on protests for the DNC. And they have also said things like, head of the DNC, we want to make bruises from Chicago police batons back to school fall fashion, make this convention as great as 1968, and really fomenting chaos and disorder ahead of the convention. So a person, a political leader who is associating with something like that has no business being in a leadership position, especially in a key leadership position like chair.
I was driving on South Lakeshore Drive today, or Lakeshore Drive, heading south today, and I saw one of the signs for one of these protest groups trying to rally support for some sort of unrest. It was just a little, you know, real estate size sign as I was going by, but I thought, wow, they're coming.
So far, it seems like protesting in Milwaukee has been pretty mild.
I've noticed that, Eric, and the reporting about it is too. And of course, they've moved them a mile away from the center, but I wonder if that's going to be the same thing in Chicago, that there'll be some protests, but it's not going to be chaos.
Yeah, of course, we have Grant Park, which is the epicenter of chaos in 1968. But getting back to council drama, there's this issue that's hanging out there right now, which is that the mayor wants to take out what some places are calling a payday loan in order to shore up the sagging finances of Chicago Public Schools. And he finds himself kind of at odds with council and also with his own board about this, because he clearly wants to make the union that installed him in office, that financed his campaign, he wants to make the teachers union happy. But there's just not going to be money unless he takes out this, what I consider to be a fairly irresponsible, huge loan. There's not going to be enough money to make the teachers union happy, to give them what they want. And so we're seeing right now the consequences of having somebody elected who is really sitting on the same side of the negotiating table as the public sector union that he's ostensibly trying to hammer out a contract with.
Eric's right to bring this up. I was talking with Gregory Pratt, previous guest of the show, this morning about this. He has described this drama as the most consequential in city government. I would totally agree. Just for context, this $300 million payday loan, it's borrowing to pay for spending we can't afford. It's called deficit borrowing. That means that we get $300 million today, but over the next 20 years, Chicagoans have to pay $620 million out of the school system to pay for this. And by the way, for the previous decade, the Chicago Teachers Union has called this out with every single mayor. They said, we can't do deficit borrowing. There are these rapacious deals with banks, these bad deals. We can't afford it. It takes out of operational spending. And that's correct. But now that they're trying to buy time for a bailout from Springfield that is not likely to come, and a bailout from the feds, which is not likely to come, they are pushing, Brandon Johnson's administration is pushing CPS to do this profligate borrowing scheme. And I hope it fails. Right now, CPS CEO Pedro Martinez is signaling that he does not think this is a good idea. The Chicago School Board, which was appointed by the mayor, is also signaling they don't think this is a good idea. And I will say, when Pedro Martinez was dragging his feet on this, rightfully so, immediately, what do you get from the Chicago Teachers Union? An email from Jackson Potter, to the vice president of the CTU, to all of its members saying, we need to ratchet up our bargaining rhetoric. Pedro Martinez is quote unquote Lightfoot leftovers. It's completely messy and horrible. And I really hope they don't go through with borrowing.
Which is true that he is a holdover from the Lightfoot administration, but Brandon Johnson could have replaced him at any time. So he is now Johnson's head Chicago Public Schools.
I'm hearing about
it's the same kind of borrowing that Johnson wants to do for a new Bear Stadium. This kind of borrowing has long-term impact on our stability as a city and a state. You can't just keep kicking money, a debt down the road, which is what we complained about three other mayors before him doing, and we have to complain about this one too.
But is the idea, Austin, Marge, Eric, that this is just a short-term loan until the state or federal government come through with the money? So it's not going to be $600 million over 30 years. We'll pay it off just as soon as the state gives us the money we need. This is a bridge loan.
When is that going to happen? When did the state say have that money?
Yeah, I'm just asking.
They went down to Springfield with their collective hats in their hands earlier this year, and they got turned away. I don't know what makes them think that they're going to get money from Springfield out of this.
I see what you mean, John, in terms of like, well, my paycheck's coming Friday.
Yes.
Once, as soon as I get it, like, you'll have the money. But that's never the way these deals work. The CTU did this in 2015, or CPS did this 2015, 16, 17. They've had budget surpluses in the past. They're not using those to accelerate payment of debt. They go with this scheduled this payment schedule. And again, that eats into millions and millions of dollars that could be used to pay for books or to renovate schools or to hire new teachers.
Put in air conditioning.
It's going to go to debt because they can't make these tough choices.
It's not clear to me where else these savings would come from, but there is a little bit of doublespeak in what I read about this, in that Johnson says he refuses to make cuts to any school-based personnel. But there was a formula of cutting more from the administration, not filling vacancies. And can you separate the vacancies at school should be filled? I know my daughter teaches at a school that doesn't have a clerk because they didn't have enough money for teachers. Like that has to be fixed. But there is more central office savings to be done. And I didn't hear Johnson address that or address other ways to economize. There's not enough money. I don't think the union or the mayor is wrong about that. There has not been enough money for books or all those other things, Austin, that you said. No one has had a viable option for where that would come from, and we haven't had enough pressure to come up with a good option, whatever that might be.
What you can expect and what we saw yesterday is that CTU had a protest about the budget, and it's just a scapegoating tour. So last week it's Pedro Martinez's fault. He wasn't fighting enough for new money in Springfield. This week it's J.B. Pritzker, you need to give us $1 billion. I don't think that's going to play well with J.B. Pritzker's people, but CTU cannot blame Brandon Johnson for this, even though the mayor could allocate political capital to trying to raise money in city council or pass tax hikes to fund this. They know that's not a good idea for him to do right now. So the focus is going on everybody but the mayor.
Less important, but the optics are kind of interesting. The mayor's staff was set to move a George Washington statue from outside his office. It was said the area might now honor a black Chicagoan instead, but now they're backing away from that. This comes on the heels, of course, after there was a piece in Chicago Magazine that said if George Washington is persona non grata, the way maybe Christopher Columbus is in the city because of historic wrongs, then maybe we should just say Washington Park or Washington Street. All the Washington stuff is Harold Washington stuff. Yeah, that's the ticket. Now, a Washington statue doesn't look like the other Washington statue, but that's sort of in the water right now. People are thinking and talking a little bit about that. So it seemed like a bad time to be moving a George Washington statue, even if this is something you would have done regardless. It looks like you're sort of caving to that sort of pressure. And I wonder how much attention we should pay to that.
Isn't this like Douglas Park, you know, that was named for Stephen Douglas, a slave owner. And the community started to respond to that by using big markers and putting an extra S on the end of Douglas, turning it into the spelling for Frederick Douglass, who was the abolitionist, former slave. It's a perfect switch from Stephen Douglas to Frederick Douglass. And it came from the community, like I said, who were just doing it on the signs by hand. And then the Park District said, oh, that's a good idea. We could do that. And your Harold Washington, George Washington flip is similar to that. And just maybe it's time to move into modern times and recognize some of the true icons in our country and let some of the tainted leaders stay in the
middle. I'm okay with that, but I also think that if the way you measure this is total good versus total evil, I mean, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg might not be a perfect person either, but they just changed the name of a school to her because she's a little purer. But everybody has good and bad. Wouldn't you weigh George Washington's good greater than his bad, his evil, the fact that he enslaved people? I mean, I would say yes. I would say George Washington is a greater good than a greater bad. You've got to take into account the context of the time, too. I'm not trying to whitewash history here, but if you just said 200 years, George Washington, good or bad.
Well, of course, the truth is that no character in history is going to pass the standards of contemporary America, right? I mean, in terms of women's rights, in terms of gay rights, and other things, they're just not going to meet our standards. And we do have to look at them through that lens of history and say, compared to others, he freed his enslaved people when he died. And he, I think, was always said to be uneasy with the institution. it doesn't give them a full pass, obviously. But again, when you have to balance out what someone does, the positive things they did versus the negative things they did, when you're talking about those sort of historical wrongs. It's not like we discovered that he's a murderer or a pedophile or something, right?
If people want to have that public conversation about George Washington specifically, let's have that conversation. But I think it was wrong for them to just do that unilaterally with the statue in City Hall, or apparently, you know, they meant to, and now they're backing off of it. And I think it would be wrong to unilaterally do that with Washington Park. I do think there should be more things named after Harold Washington, for sure. But yeah, no one is going to pass that smell test. Very few people, anyway. Frederick Douglass himself said a lot of racist things about Native Americans. There are very few people who are just 100% pure. It's kind of interesting in this day and age with Donald Trump, who did try to overturn a federal election to stay in power, that we would not at least give a public conversation for George Washington, who is so famous for having begun with no real, you know, modern role models, the tradition of stepping down from power, even though, as I'm sure everybody knows, people begged him to stay in power. People wanted him to be king, and he refused to do so. But I think that's the main thing, that you need to have that public conversation. And he did change his mind over the course of his life. And I think we do have to give people credit for things like that, too. He did change his mind over the course of his life. He did free the slaves that he did own, that he had the power to free.
Yeah, I'm going to free the slaves when I'm gone and I don't need them anymore. I'm sorry, Kate, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But I don't think there's a world in which you would weigh good against slavery, and slavery doesn't come out as the most important piece.
Everyone in the past has something, Marge, and slavery has been a global, international.
So nobody before the Civil War,
then. History.
Yeah, but other people stood up against it. Look, the whole GOP is standing in line behind Trump right now, and Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney are finding a voice to say, no, this is wrong. People during George Washington's time spoke up and said, you're owning human beings, that's wrong.
Sure. I mean, I am saying, sure, if everyone wants to have that conversation, let's really explore him more, and maybe I would be convinced. I'm not convinced yet, and I'm definitely not convinced that everyone automatically, with that much going for them, like George Washington, should be thrown out.
Well, how would you gauge, Marge, Abraham Lincoln here in the land of Lincoln? I just traveled up and down Lincoln Avenue the other day. Everything is named Lincoln up and down the street. I'm halfway through Eric Larson's Demon of Unrest, where they talk about the battle in Charleston and South Carolina's role in leading us into a civil war. And they keep emphasizing, the author does, that Abraham Lincoln was perplexed that he couldn't convince the South that they could keep their slaves. He was not going to free the slaves. That was Abraham Lincoln's position on it.
I don't think that I will sit here and say get rid of either of them. But what I think where Kate and I are agreeing is this conversation about a community process. That's what I brought up the Douglas Park example for. Yeah. That came from the community. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I have some of Eric's concerns about her legacy as well. But the community came forward and chose that for their own school.
Yep.
And I think we need to have a discussion about Washington. And when you ask, George Washington did a lot of good. Isn't that outweigh the bad of slavery? Nothing outweighs the bad of slavery. We're still living the repercussions of slavery and the inequities that go back to our discussion about the disinvestment in communities and the teen groups and the money for the CPS. All of this is about an inequity.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. I don't want to answer that question, but I would like the community to say whether they're comfortable with the kinds of tributes to the old guard leaders now that we have a sort of more contemporary view.
President Obama was originally very much against gay marriage. Is that going to mean that he gets canceled?
Actually, Kate, in fact, he was actually in favor of gay marriage when he was running for
state senate.
And
then he was against it, right.
Then he was against it.
Which is kind of worse.
And he has had his finger to the wind on that issue until Biden, God bless him, sort of forced him out and made him endorse gay marriage. Yeah. I mean, Obama. But just to get back to John's point, Abraham Lincoln, there's some very unfortunate and inconvenient quotes from Lincoln about his feelings about African Americans, or I forget how he would have referred to them. But one of his solutions at one point was to send them all back to Africa. I think you do have to say that in the main, Abraham Lincoln, yes, he was a racist by our standards. By his time, he was enlightened, and he deserves a lot of credit for emancipating the slaves and for leading the Civil War. And so I don't think you can say, well, because he said these awful racist things, by our standards, we can't venerate him. Otherwise, you won't be able to venerate anyone in history, anyone even probably before 1980 or so, right? I mean, that they were all backward people by our standards today. I think putting these things in context and not whitewashing them, as someone said earlier in the conversation, saying, like, let's acknowledge that these were flawed human beings. Let's not turn them into gods. When we're talking about the founders of our country, let's not pretend that they didn't have huge blind spots and that we need to venerate everything about them. Taking down the statue, I go, one more thing is, I'm not exactly sure why there's a statue of George Washington in City Hall.
I mean,
he ain't from here, and it's he's a federal figure, national figure, not an Illinois or local figure. But
I would make that case. Eric also suggested in our Google Doc that about Andrew Jackson, if something is named after Jackson in Chicago, the solution would be say, no, that's the Jackson 5. And they're from nearby.
It was either that or the other Jackson family, the Jesse.
It could
Jackson
be the Jesse
family.
That would work too.
I mean, obviously,
Mahalia Jackson,
or Mahalia Jackson, or Reggie Jackson.
He's more a Chicagoan. I mean, not born here, but made it at home.
I would say Michael Jackson is problematic, and of course Jesse Jr. Problematic anyway. But
Jesse Singer, for that matter.
For that matter, yeah. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, then never mind. We'll just get rid of them.
Van Buren also. I mean, guilt by association, of course.
Bad path to go down.
We'll just go Street A, Statue B, Park C. That's the way to do it.
The blinders that we need in order to cope today, I guess. I just came back from a week at a lake, a lovely lake in Michigan, where unfortunately our beautiful view was marred by a flag, Trump 2024. And underneath it said, no more. And I got riled up. Like, how can I enjoy this lake when so no more? What is they talking about? He's nothing but. To which my daughter came up with the plan. I think they're admonishing him. Trump in 2024, no more bull.
Yes.
And then I could relax.
Yeah. Well, one last thing for you guys as we go, but let's just go back to the rhetoric, though, which is being sort of thrown around. So at the RNC, they're saying we need to dial down the rhetoric because of what happened last weekend, and we need to unite the nation. And as Brandon said a little while ago, they're so confident right now that they can moderate their rhetoric and still feel good about their chances. And I get that. But I wonder how you judge what is or is not appropriate or sufficiently dialed down rhetoric. If, for instance, you want to say that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, which a lot of people feel, some Republicans are saying, no, that's the sort of language that we all need to step away from. And I think you can still feel that without wishing violence on anybody. It's hard to know what is, or I guess it all depends on the beholder, but what is or isn't fair game now. Can you mock the other side, President Trump, who has been acting moderate and quiet this week, did post on his platform a picture of him dodging a bullet and he's strong. And then there's a picture of Joe Biden stumbling on stairs and he's weak. I guess that's still fair game. That's not inciting violence, but it's not the sort of unifying rhetoric that the Republicans are asking for this week.
I think a lot of people on the right took the wrong lesson from the Sarah Palin, Gabby Giffords controversy, which if you'll remember after the Giffords shooting, Sarah Palin was in a world of hurt because there was some kind of fundraising mailer or something like that that showed a bullseye and crosshairs around areas where you wanted to change leadership. And the lesson that the right seems to have taken from that is, oh, we should be able to attack anyone who has even the slightest bit of incendiary rhetoric on the left if something bad happens to someone on our side. And I think that's the wrong lesson. I think that people, you can say something like, this candidate is a threat to democracy, for example, and that's completely fair game. That doesn't mean that that person should be killed. And you see these examples like folks bringing up, you know, Biden said he's a threat to democracy or things of that nature. Now, the cover of the New Republic with Trump as Hitler, like, yeah, that's really incendiary. And of course, all of us have talked about, you
why
know,
is that incendiary?
If you
no, well, I mean, I'm serious. Why?
In our current culture, the number one thing people would do with a time machine is kill baby Hitler. And I think maybe if you ask people on this panel, they'd say like, yeah, that would be a good idea to kill Hitler. So if there's a Hitler in our midst, maybe that means I still think that is within bounds, by the way. I
think you do that's think that's within
totally
bounds
okay.
Because you don't think that some of the things that Project 20, what was the meme this week? Project 2025 would be easier understood if you read it in the original German. Isn't there some corollary? At least there's a logic thread.
Yeah, well, I think there's often folks who talk about political polarization today do not have a historical lens of how polarized we were before like the 90s. I think people are mostly just thinking of the 90s. They're not thinking about all of American and world political history before that, which was very highly polarized and incendiary. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to produce violence. I do think an actual sort of threat to democracy, an actual like source of violence that even though it's been talked about a lot, still is not being talked about enough, is what the accountability mechanism is going to be for the Secret Service for what occurred on Saturday. Completely inexcusable. An investigation is obviously in order, but it's simply not enough. If there aren't people who are immediately fired because of the blatant failure of that, it sends a message that that kind of behavior is okay and it will go through some investigatory process. There was someone responsible for that, for security that day. There's an org chart where you have the responsible person. That person should be immediately fired. And you don't need an investigation to do it. I think that's focusing on that, I think, would be a much better use of anger from the right.
I just want to know
that was local police jurisdiction and who made that decision about, while it is physically farther than the security perimeter, the accessibility from that route was still directly to the podium. So someone made the decision to make that property the responsibility of local police. And that's the answer I'd like to hear.
I just wonder if we're making too much of what this deranged, troubled young man did and saying that he is emblematic of something that's going to happen, that, you know, Donald Trump Jr. said, they took a shot at my father. It wasn't they did it. It was a registered Republican, a very troubled young man who did this. It had been 43 years in this country since a major political figure had been targeted by an assassin. And I think that we when we talk about this is like some sort of turning point. I don't think we have any evidence that it is. This was not an organized plot like in like the guys in Michigan who wanted to get together and
there was no manifesto. We have no knowledge of this young man's politics.
And why one can deplore political violence, I think we all on this panel do. Everyone does. It's not a way to address problems. I think to say that there's an epidemic of it or something is misstating the situation. I think we are still so far, with the exception of January 6th, we're fighting this out on ideological lines on the debate stage in the ballot box.
But when you talk about the rhetoric, I think the big difference, to answer your last question, John, is between the policy statement and the personal statement. So to say that Trump is a threat to democracy, you could say Trump's agenda is a threat to democracy, but that's splitting hairs in a way that I don't think makes a difference. I think that's a legitimate thing to say. When Trump posts a picture of Biden's face superimposed on a person tied up in the back of a pickup truck, that's pretty hot rhetoric, and it should be disavowed and disallowed. When he has a picture of him punching the CNN reporter, all those kinds of things, that rhetoric, when he's in a rally and says, take him outside, in my day, they beat him up, you know what to do, that's violent rhetoric about people. And 90% of that comes from the other side. But that's the rhetoric that we shouldn't have. And I don't think, Eric, we're talking about an epidemic of political shootings, but we've opened the door now. The number one domestic violence threat or domestic terrorism threat That guy fits the profile, right? Young, radicalized white men with guns. And they're out there, and there are others who will see that. There's a chance for copycats, whether they're aiming at Trump or they're aiming at Biden. It's opened a door that I would just as soon have been remained closed.
But I also don't know that this is I'm surprised that you say a radicalized young man. It's possible that he shot at Donald Trump because he was angry at the world, and this is a way to go out and have people know your name. We don't know that he was against Donald Trump or against Republicans or against Democrats or anything, do we?
But he was radicalized in his vision of gun violence.
What do you mean by radicalized?
Well, I think that he was a part of this gun culture. The T-shirt that he had referred to a website that is about extremely violent weapons, something I never heard of before, a punch gun.
Sure.
Like, he's on this radical end of gun aficionados. That's what I mean.
I see. We'll wrap it up there. Marge Halperin, Kate Plies, Austin Berg, Brandon Pope is probably at a restaurant in Milwaukee right now. Eric Zorn, everybody, thanks for joining us on the podcast this week.
Okay. Good to see you. I'm gone the next 3 weeks, so.
Yeah.
Whoa. Wow.
What are you doing?
I'm going to music camp, and I'm going to a college reunion, and I'm on a road trip with Johanna, so.
The Menzies Rascals do not allot that many vacation days, so that would be 3 weeks. And I think you're still at only 2 weeks, Eric. So
that's true.
Have a good trip. Have a good time.
All right.
Miss you.
All right. Thanks. I will be listening. I'll be listening for sure.
See we you. Are produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Thank you, ladies.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.